Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Lee F. Little, Independent Executives versus the Expert Corporation from Gray County. Texas Instruments Incorporated versus Teletron Energy Management Incorporated from Harris County. Elizabeth G. Krishnan, M.D. versus Humberto Sepulveda, Jr. and Olga Sepulveda from Hidalgo County, and Grace Newhouse Richards and others versus Vernon F. Newhouse, Jr. and others from Hidalgo County. In the first three of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes per side for oral argument, and the final 15 per minute per side in the first, 20 per side in the second and third, and 25 minutes per side in the fourth. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments, but will conclude the arguments before a late lunch. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. You may make application with our clerk if you wish to listen to a tape of the argument. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Little versus Expert.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. In early 1989, four families formed a small operating oil and gas company called Expert Corporation. Each of these four families owned 25% of this company. There were some pre-existing business relationships between at least two of these families. One of the founders of this corporation had been the Littles, certified public accountant for many years before the formation of this business, and continued to operate as their certified public accountant during the venture and up until the time that Mr. Little died. After the formation of this business, the four families entered into what is known as a buy-sell agreement. The buy-sell agreement, which is the contract which is before the court today, had two purposes. One, to take care of the inter vivos sale of stock, and one, to take care of what happens to the insurance proceeds in the event of the death of one of the stockholders. The buy-sell agreement provided for the purchase of $250,000 of term life insurance for each of the operating stockholders in this corporation. In our view, this case is a case that involves solely the contractual issues surrounding the buy-sell agreement. The insurance contract itself was a result of the buy-sell agreement, but I don't believe that the insurance contract is before the court. An express purpose of the buy-sell contract was to address the precise question which is before this court today. That is to say, what happens when a stockholder sells his stock, and more specifically, what happens to the insurance proceeds or the insurance benefits that have been taken care of in the context of that contract. The contract addresses this point directly. And before I get to the specific clause in the contract that I want to focus on for the court, I will say that background facts that the Littles elected to sell their stock in March of 1991. The actual certificates of stock were signed over March 31st of 1991. There were closing transactions and assignments that carried over even past the date of death of Mr. Little, which was 33 days later on May the 3rd. So the sale happened on March 31st. There were closing transactions happening, and he died on May the 3rd. The contract provision, which I think is most significant for determining what the intent of these parties was, is paragraph 10. I have taken a blow-up for the court's convenience to reiterate paragraph 10 in its entirety on the easel. We do not believe that paragraph 10 is ambiguous, although that was one of the questions that was faced by the lower courts and by the parties. We believe that the paragraph 10 is very clear in its language. It has no magic word to mark. It is language which we believe that almost all laymen understand. In the event of the sale of the stockholder's interest, which sets up the condition, and we have stipulated that we sold the stock. So the condition proceeding to effectuate this clause has happened. In that event, the selling stockholders are entitled to retain all contracts and insurance appertaining to the agreement.
You don't contend that there was any provision in the contract which triggered an obligation on the owner to change the designation of beneficiary, do you?
No, sir, I don't. I believe it is clear from this clause that this clause is self-executing, that there is nothing explained in this clause in order for the business to be entitled to the insurance benefits as well as the death proceeds.
But merely retaining a contract does not mean you're the beneficiary. This has to be tied in with paragraph 3 if it's to work at all. Is it not?
Paragraph 3 is
also... This in itself gives you no rights other than to own a contract of insurance, which does not mean you're the beneficiary.
Our impression of paragraph 10 is that the triggering condition is the sale of the stockholder's interest. Once that condition has happened, that the stockholder who sells is entitled to the insurance contract and all benefits that flow from that contract.
Why the benefits?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Why the benefits? Ordinarily, the benefits do not necessarily follow the transfer of the contract. I can sell or give somebody an insurance contract without changing the beneficiary.
That's true.
And without meaning for them to get the benefits.
That's true.
Then they can change it if they want to.
When these parties entered into this contract in 1989, it was the intent of the parties at that time, both by this clause and also by paragraph 6 to the contract and paragraph 3 to the contract, that it be self-executing, that when a stockholder sells, they are entitled to the insurance benefits without having to take any further action. Had there been any reason for the parties to have taken any action to be entitled to it, it would have been spelled out in this contract as a condition preceded, if you will.
If one agrees with you that this provision is self-executing to the extent that it transfers the ownership of the policy, why does it also transfer ownership of the benefits?
That distinction was attempted to be made, and the Court of Civil Appeals decided that there was no distinction between the intentions of these parties to segregate the ownership of the policy from the benefit, the death benefits, or the proceeds of that policy. I subscribe to that theory. I think that the contract is clear that it is the benefits of the insurance contract, including the death benefit, which are at issue and which were addressed by the parties at the time the contract was signed, and that no distinction was ever made by the parties when they entered in upon this business venture to make some technical distinction between who owned the policy and who was entitled to the benefits of the policy. These businessmen did not address that issue. It was not bargained for.
Before the buy-sell provision was exercised, the corporation owned the policies and was beneficiary of the policies.
That's correct, sir.
It makes little sense to say once you've sold your stock, you retain or acquire, actually, I suppose, ownership of the policy and then leave the benefits with the corporation when the whole purpose for which the corporation owned and was beneficiary to begin with has already transpired, that is, acquisition of the stock.
I believe there was a recognition by these four families that they were buying this insurance policy for the purpose of benefiting the surviving spouse of the stockholder. Now, it is true that most of the emphasis in the buy-sell contract was designed, I think, to address the situation where a stockholder dies while he owns the stock. Nevertheless,
these funds would be utilized to acquire any spousal interest in the stock.
Yes,
remaining stockholders in the corporation. But once that's taken place, there's no rational basis for the corporation to retain any beneficiary interests.
None whatsoever.
That's already transpired.
That's correct. That's the way I see that. I want to point out that the Court of Civil Appeals apparently took the position that paragraph 10 sets up an option contract. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think paragraph 10, as I say, is self-executing. I think it was intended by these parties at the time that this contract was signed to benefit the selling stockholders so that whatever blood, sweat, and tears had been put into this business venture, that this was part of their contribution. It was on
Mr.
their
Mr. let me on your question, I mean, on your statement about what it was designed for, on question 10, the companies, no question, get insurance to cover the buy-sell agreement provision. There's no question that the shareholder, when he sells the stock, has the right to retain the contract of insurance. It seems to me that the value of this to a shareholder is if in the event in the future they become insurable, here's an opportunity to continue some insurance on their lives in the event that they sell their stock and they're out of this company. They have insurance on their lives. They don't have to prove medical insurability. They can carry the policy with them. That means that they've got to pay the premiums. If they pull out of this deal, sell their shares, they have the right to retain the contracts, but is it not also accepted that they would pay the premiums in the future on this insurance on their life?
I think there's no question about that, John.
So the question comes down, we have this circumstance where a sale of the stock occurs, the shareholder has the right to retain the contracts, has chosen not to do so. The facts are just as consistent with the shareholder choosing not to do so. Let's assume that the shareholder says, I don't want to pay the freight for this insurance on my life, chooses not to do so. There is still some closing documents. Shareholder dies, and now the estate comes in and says, he would have taken ownership of the stock, I mean, of the contracts, had he lived long enough to do so. But he failed to do so. But that doesn't seem to be the claim that's made here. The claim that's made here is we're just entitled to the benefits because obviously all it was designed to do was buy the stock and they bought the stock. But the fact of the matter is there's another element to this is that the shareholder, having sold the shares, would have to take on the obligations of these contracts, insuring their lives as the owners. Isn't it, how do you get past this notion that this gentleman may have chosen not to want to take on the freight of paying for this insurance?
No, I think paragraph 10 does two things. I think it sets up the situation that when this term life insurance is up for renewal, which was in July of 1991, no question the shareholder has this. Paragraph 10 sets up an implied covenant that at that point it is that shareholder's right to renew that contract. It also sets up the situation that if the stockholder dies or the selling stockholder dies during that time, those rights to the insurance contracts have already been vested in that stockholder.
Do the facts indicate how they were paying for this insurance? Was it paid up?
It was term life insurance.
Well, was it paid on a yearly basis?
Already paid up.
Already paid up?
It was fully paid up until July of that year. So I believe paragraph 10 sets up the situation where when the contract comes up for renewal, it is the stockholder's right to renew that contract. Paragraph 10 also sets up the interim situation where the benefits have already been paid for, that the selling stockholder is entitled to that benefit. I'd like to point out for the court a case that is not cited in our brief, and I think it is a very significant case because it, I think, explains what the Court of Civil Appeals was trying to do in setting this up as an optional contract and applying or implying an additional condition preceding to this contract. That case is I believe to be the leading case in Texas with respect to option contracts. It is Jones versus Gibbs, decided in 1939 by the Supreme Court, 130 Southwest 2nd, 265. Later reaffirmed by End of the Hills Limited versus Shulgin and Kaiser, 723 Southwest 2nd, 299, writ refused, NRE. The End of the Hills case was an express condition case, a condition preceding case, just as was Jones versus Gibbs. It was a lease with a renewal clause conditioned upon giving of notice. Lessee failed to give the notice. The primary term expired. the lessor contended the lessee's rights were forfeited. Court held otherwise, saying that mere negligence is not to be used as punishment. If that's the case, the purpose of the permission is settled.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Warlick, comments will then argue the response.
May it please the court. The respondent, Expert Corporation, feels that this is really a simple case. And in looking at the brief filed by the appellant, it would indicate there's a lot of complicating factors in the case, but we feel that that is not so. It's really a simple case in the fact that I think the only issue before this court is whether the buy-sell agreement requires Expert Corporation to pay over the policy proceeds to the estate of Jimmy Little under the terms of paragraph 10. In construing that contract, obviously the court will need to look at the contract as a whole, which I think it has, as manifested by your reference to paragraph 3, paragraph 6, paragraph 10. But also, I think we'd have to interpret this contract not only from the four corners of the instrument itself, but from the prevailing law at that time concerning the assignment of insurance contracts. Paragraph 10 deals with the situation where there is an inter vivos transfer of stock by stockholder in the corporation. Paragraph 6 talks about the fact where there is a death of a stockholder during the time that he is a stockholder in the corporation. And in the brief and in the arguments of counsel for the appellant, they would like to mix and match these. They would like to bring from paragraph 6 provisions there and try to apply them in situation. You cannot do that. Paragraph 6 expressly talks about what the agreement or sets forth the agreement of the parties when the stockholder died, what to do with the insurance when he died. Paragraph 10 talks about the fact what they're to do with the life insurance policy on an insured stockholder when he sells his stock. There are two separate situations, back situations, and each paragraph sets forth the agreement of the parties as to what was to happen in the case of those two instances.
Is there any more business purpose for the maintenance of a $250,000 life insurance policy on a stockholder that's sold his shares in the company?
I know of no business purpose on the part of the expert, and there may be a business purpose on the part of the shareholder, as was addressed by one of the justices here, that he may want to continue his insurance because of insurability or whatever it may be.
This is a summary judgment case, and yes. The opposing party has alleged that Expert became Expert, which had the exclusive right to change the designation of beneficiary under this policy, has become a constructive trustee for these benefits and owes a duty to pay those over to Mr. Little's widow. Can you explain to me why you've established as a matter of law that that cannot, contention cannot prevail?
Your Honor, I think the reasons for that are the fact that under paragraph 10 of the buy-sell agreement, there is no provision or no obligation on the part of Expert Corporation, the owner and the beneficiary of the policy at the time of the death, to do anything. It merely says that anyone who sells his stock in the corporation shall have the right to retain all insurance contracts on his or her life. Now, that does not place any burden on Expert to do anything. And I think, to the contrary, it places the burden on the selling shareholder to do whatever he wants to do with the policies that's on his life. He can come in and say, I want these assigned to me. And when he does, he can do with them whatever he'd like. He can change the beneficiary. He could discontinue the payment of the premiums. He could pledge the policy or do whatever an owner of the policy could do.
So do you agree that the change in ownership is self-executed?
Will you ask that again, please?
Do you agree that the change in ownership was self-executed?
I don't think it was. I think the ownership could only be changed by the policy provisions or by a contract entered into the parties that clearly shows an intent to change the beneficial interest in policy.
So your position is that expert retained ownership of this policy after the sale of stock?
Yes, until such time as that ownership was changed by an assignment from expert over to Mr. Little. And Mr. Little may not have cared for the assignment of the policy, in which event experts would have continued to own the policy until such time as the premium payment was due, and they would have then the questions whether or not they wanted to continue the payment of premiums on the policy on his life.
Could they have continued the payment?
They had an insurable interest. They had insurable interest in the insurance code, and they could have continued to pay the
premium. Expert had an insurable interest?
After he no longer owned any stock?
I think under the insurance code, once you you have an insurable interest, it continues there.
Mr. Thomas, you just made a statement that sounds strange to me. Help me to understand the statement you made. I heard you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, I heard you say that Mr. Little could have opted to reject the prepaid insurance on his life. Does that make any sense? Help me understand that.
Well, he could if he wanted to. In other words, he could come in and
a rational person is going to reject prepaid insurance of $250,000 when they don't have to pay a cent?
I would not have done that.
Well, but that's what you are. Aren't you arguing that?
I'm arguing whether or not he should or should not have done it. I don't know. I'm saying under paragraph 10 of the contract that he had the right or the option to have that assigned to him. And whether or not he would do that would be up to him. Whether or not he should or should not have done it, obviously a question for him.
Assuming you're right, that under paragraph 10, an affirmative election has to be made in order for the selling stockholder to take advantage of this, how come that has to be done by Mr. Little before he died? In other words, no activity was required until July 31st. It was paid up through June 30th or July 31st.
That's correct.
How come this right, if it's there, disappeared when Mr. Little died? Why couldn't his widow make the election at or before the time that first premium had to be paid in the summer after his death?
You mean why did she not make it after his death?
Yes.
I think after his death, the terms of the policy would dictate it would be paid to the beneficiary of the policy. And I think under paragraph 10 of the...
Well, under paragraph 3, you come in after the death and kind of settle up on the basis of this money. And that was the whole purpose of this scheme, as I understand it, was there'd be some money there to buy out one of the partners.
Well, I'd like to, since we mentioned paragraph 3, I would like to read this, the last portion of that. It says that the proceeds are to be used, talk about them with them then, the proceeds are to be used to fund the purchase price of the total stock purchase in said corporation. That's in case you have a stockholder who dies. And it says otherwise, such insurance proceeds shall be payable to expert upon death of any deceased insured stockholder and shall become an asset of expert. And so what in fact paragraph 3 says that if a stockholder dies while he is a stockholder, that those proceeds can or cannot be used to pay for his stock in the corporation.
What I hear in that provision is that they wanted to be sure the money was there if a current stockholder died.
That's correct.
They might have other assets of which they could acquire that stock, in which case the proceeds of the insurance would become an asset of the corporation because of the death of a current stockholder, and they used other assets to acquire those stock, deceased than the insurance. But it's an offset situation.
But paragraph 3 also says if the proceeds are there and are not used to pay the purchase price for a deceased shareholder.
Then they become an offset.
Those proceeds are to be retained by the corporation.
Then they become an offset for the assets that were used.
And in this case, they were not used. He had already sold the stock.
That's right.
And so they were not used to pay that. And so I think paragraph 3 indicates an intent of the parties that since they were not used to pay purchase price for his stock, they then would be payable to Expert Corporation unless...
Isn't that an inherent conflict with the provision paragraph 10 that gives the stockholder who sells the right to retain the ownership and presumably the benefits of the policy?
I don't think it's a conflict when that, if you construe paragraph 10 as to being an option and does not, as a matter of law, upon the sale of his stock in the corporation, at that time, make his estate become the beneficiary of the policy. I think that would be a conflict.
I think the difficult question that the court is struggling here is trying to determine what rational or equitable interest Expert has in the proceeds of this policy once it has acquired the stock of Little. When the contract provision relating to the buy-sell situation relating to the sale of the stock has been exercised, and equitable interest apparently at that time moves to Little.
Well, let me speak to that, Your Honor. At the time that Little sold his stock, he was paid apparently well for the stock. He was paid a considerable amount of money for his stock, and apparently he felt that he was adequately compensated for having sold his stock back to one of the stockholders, the other stockholders. All the premiums on that had been paid by the corporation, not by Mr. Little. And so they were the owner of the contingent policy. They had paid all the premiums on the policy for several years. And then he sells his stock, he gets fully compensated, and he walks off from his relationship with the corporation. So I don't think there's any equity on the side of the estate there.
I think you would say that's the benefit of the bargain. He did pay indirectly for that insurance as a stockholder during his lifetime.
His proportion part.
Mr. Thomas, you kind of discounted paragraph 6 in the buy-sell, but if I read paragraph 3 correctly, the spouse of the shareholder can exercise an option to maintain an interest in the corporation, in which event the proceeds of the insurance policy become an asset of the corporation.
That's correct.
In paragraph 6, the spouse, if the spouse has elected to take the insurance proceeds, it is accepted as payment for the stock. But the last provision in paragraph 6 says, in the event that the stock is not worth as much as the insurance proceeds, the balance of the proceeds go to the spouse. Now you come to paragraph 10, which says, shareholder, when they sell their interest, have the right to retain the contracts of insurance. Why can't the court, reading all three of paragraphs consistent, say that what the shareholders have done in this corporation have expressed an intent that the spouse benefit from the insurance proceeds in the event that the insurance proceeds exceed the value of the stock? Taking paragraph 10, I've now sold all my stock back to the corporation. The corporation's paid for the stock. There is no value left. We now have 100% of the proceeds out here. There's nothing left to be purchased from the corporation. Why hasn't the document itself expressed an intent that the shareholders intended for the spouse to keep the proceeds, irrespective of who the owner of the policy is, irrespective of who the beneficiary is? Reading the three provisions together, where do we find an agreement that Expert retains the proceeds of the insurance policy?
I think really the answer to that, it would be the reverse of that. I think under the existing law that, as far as I know, still exists today, that in order to assign an interest in a life insurance policy or to release or relinquish an interest in a life insurance policy, where you were releasing or relinquishing or assigning the beneficial interest or the policy proceeds, you have to do that with an expressed intent to do so. And I cannot see from examining this document that there was ever any expressed intent to do so.
So if it was a death situation, you do have an expressed intent in paragraph 6. But if it's a live transaction here, you do not.
You have not expressed it. You do not have anywhere an expressed intent manifested on the part of the parties to assign or to relinquish the beneficial interest or the proceeds of the insurance policy. And I think under the Parker case and the other cases cited in our brief, that this is required. And nowhere in paragraph 10 do you have a reference to beneficial interest. You have a reference to proceeds of the policy. It merely says that they have the right to retain all insurance contracts on their lives. Now, let me say something about retaining real quickly. Up until the death of Mr. Little, Expert Corporation was the owner and the beneficiary of the policy. The proceeds, obviously, under an insurance contract go to the beneficiary of the policy. Mr. Little could not be the beneficiary of the policy because he was insured. You cannot be the insured and be the beneficiary of both. So there was nothing to retain that he had. And so now what they're asking, I think, is the court to rewrite this contract and say, in effect, that what the parties intended was that if he died after he had sold all of his stock in the corporation, after he died, then the proceeds of that contract would be paid to his estate.
Mrs. Little was a stockholder as well.
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'd like to address a comment that Justice Stewart hit on, and I think it is instructive. Paragraph 3 and paragraph 6, to point up what I think to be the kind of nonsensical nature of what I believe to be Expert's argument. Suppose that instead of the Little selling all of their shares, they sold all shares save one. This result wouldn't even be questioned because paragraph 6 would require that the balance of the insurance proceeds be paid entirely for that one share of stock, irrespective of what the value of that one share of stock was. Seems to me that brings us right back to what the intention of these parties was at the beginning when this contract was signed. They intended to take care of their respective wives. They intended to take care of their respective wives whether or not the stock was sold during the life of the stockholder or whether he died owning the stock. There is, if I can mention it, a childhood game that I think is appropriate to mention here. The childhood game is called May I, and I can give you a citation for that if you'd like. But the game goes, one child is the leader, others are parallel in the front yard, and the child who's the leader in sequence says to Glee Little, you can take 6 giant steps forward. Now, she doesn't say the magic words, May I, she forfeits her right and she has to go back to the beginning of the line.
Let me ask you another question. If we just have a simple contract, A conveys to B a policy of insurance attached to this contract, does that transfer by that contract the right to the benefits of the policy regardless of who his name is the beneficiary?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure I can answer that without a few more facts. I'll take the easy way out of that. But in contrast to this policy, I mean, this buy-sell agreement, I think this buy-sell agreement very clearly indicates that it is not only the ownership of the policy, it's not so much these folks didn't think about who owns the policy, who's entitled to the benefits of the policy.
So in my hypothetical, you say you can't tell.
I couldn't tell by that.
If Mr. Little had lived past the anniversary date of the policy, July,
yes.
At that point, somebody would have had to make the decision in the expert office, are we going to pay these premiums or is he going to pay them?
Correct.
And do you agree that they had an insurable interest that they could have continued to pay them?
I do not.
So if he had lived, he would the of necessity made a positive choice.
Yes.
But since he died, the provision that number 10 says the right to retain, he still had the right to retain.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that to be true.
Under Article 10, the equitable interest moved to him upon the sale, is what you're saying.
That's correct. That is.
The other side's arguing that that's ownership, but doesn't have anything to do with beneficiary. Is there any rational, reasonable basis for someone to acquire ownership by equitable transfer of a policy and then leave the beneficiary where it was in an entity in which he has no interest, number one. And number two, along with ownership comes the power to designate beneficiary. Any rational basis for someone designating an entity in which they have no interest as beneficiary when other contract provisions provide for spousal benefits?
I would see no rational benefit, certainly under these facts, for Mr. Little to have been entitled to ownership but to have left the beneficiary designated as the corporation. I don't think that he had to do that. The contract was drawn up and designed, I think, to obviate some of those kinds of technical problems. I think paragraph 6, paragraph 10, and paragraph 3 all address that precise point. Paragraph 3 specifically, and it is the only paragraph that gives the corporation any right to the insurance proceeds at all. It is the only place in that contract that you'll find that the corporation is entitled to proceeds, and that is at the election of the surviving stockholder to say, I'll keep the stock, you keep the cash. I like the prospects of what this corporation may be able to do.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.